The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, as the Trump administration continues to take actions against colleges and universities, we'll speak with Dr. Javidan Rodriguez, president of the University at Albany. And new research shows how stress affects the body at the cellular level. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. The Trump administration continues to take action against leading colleges and universities. As the White House seeks to deport international students who spoke out against Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza, eliminate funding for academic research, and pressure institutions to comply with the president's political agenda, the leaders of private and public institutions alike are monitoring changes to federal education policy closely. Earlier this month, Dr. Javidan Rodriguez, the president of the University at Albany, wrote to students, faculty, and staff that UAlbany is not abandoning its mission or values. I spoke with Dr. Rodriguez about his message to the campus community.
We are, as an institution of higher education, obviously are strongly committed to educating engaged global citizens and to making sure that our students are successful, right? And our faculty, staff, and students at the University at Albany can continue to be engaging in engaging our students in receiving the very best education and trying to ameliorate all the issues and challenges that we confront at the regional, at the local, and at the national level. And you referenced my letter to the university community. And the idea here was to inform the community that we are taking stock of what's happening at the national level, whether it relates to federal grants. And as you know, the University at Albany is a Research One institution. So we heavily depend on research grants. Any changes that might occur at the federal level, as had happened with the National Institute of Health grants and now with the Department of Energy grants, clearly impact UAlbany and impact institutions of higher education, particularly research institutions. So we want to make sure that our community is aware that we're taking stock, that we're looking, we're learning, we're listening to see what happens at the national level. We have a team at the University at Albany that is sort of taking stock of all these issues and working across the community. And so we want to know, we want our community to know that we are informed and that we're taking action wherever it needs to be. So we're working very closely, for example, with researchers at the University at Albany that have had their grants impacted. For the most part, those have been now ongoing, and so no major issues there, but we're paying attention to other changes. We're working very closely with our international students, making sure that they feel that they are, that they feel safe at the University at Albany, and they feel that the institution is looking out for them and working with them to provide them any information that may be needed, given the national, again, executive orders that are being signed as it relates to internationalization as well.
Now, President Rodriguez, do you have any estimates as to how much federal aid the university does receive to support research programs?
Well, as a Research One institution, this past year, we had about $142 million in research expenditures. That is the official number that we report to the National Science Foundation as required by the federal agency. So we, at this point in time, we have a little bit over $142 million in research expenditures. That makes us a Research One institution. And this funding comes from a diversity of sources, mainly from the federal government, National Science Foundation, National Institutes of Health, NOAA, Department of Education, but also from state grants as well.
But looking long term, do you predict any effects where research programs would have to be curtailed at the university, or that it could have a psychological impact on students, potential students who may be interested in pursuing careers in research-driven fields?
Well, you know, concerns are always real, and people are concerned about the challenges that we are all confronting. At this point in time, the university will continue to embark in its research enterprise, continuing to develop proposals and submit proposals to federal agencies. We're doing that on a regular basis, right? The changes of what's happening in D.C. hasn't stopped our work at the University at Albany. We're also looking at other opportunities that might be opening up at the national level, let's say artificial intelligence, cybersecurity, homeland security. Those are areas that we see growing opportunities there. You know, our major concern is for the federal and administrative costs of the grants that might be reduced to 15%. And our rates are much higher than that. And those fundings are used to support the research that's happening here at the University at Albany, to pay for salaries of faculty and staff, to pay for stipends for students. So if that FNA is reduced to 15% across the board, it will have significant impact. That was what NIH proposed. As you know, there was a lawsuit, there was a temporary injunction, and then recently a permanent injunction by a federal judge. And I know the federal government is trying to appeal that. And so that is our work in progress. In the meantime, we will continue to embark on, you know, life-saving research, whether it be myotonic dystrophy, whether it be cancer, whether it be diabetes, and other types of research that we have here at the University at Albany.
Now, President Rodriguez, how are you working with the SUNY chancellor or other university presidents within the SUNY system in the face of these federal changes?
So there, there's a series of networks, if you will, in which we are working on. So as part of SUNY, obviously the largest comprehensive university system in the country, we are working in particularly the research centers, university centers, Binghamton, Buffalo, Stony Brook, and New Albany. We're working very closely with the chancellor. We're working very closely with system. We're monitoring the impact on research grants, on international students, et cetera, because we want to take a holistic and comprehensive approach and response as a system to these issues as they emerge. So we are literally in daily contact with the chancellor's office and with other people at SUNY, the Research Foundation, and others to make sure that we are all on the same page and that the actions that we're taking are actions that will benefit our institutions, will benefit our faculty, staff, and students, and protect our faculty, staff, and students, and certainly work as an entire system. So at that level, I'm working very closely with the chancellor and others at SUNY. I also serve on a number of boards across the nation, the Association of Public Land Grants and Universities, Excellencia in Education, Campus Compact, just to name a few. And these are organizations at the national level that are having discussions about the issues, the challenges posed by executive orders, and the impact that it is having on institutions of higher education. So, for example, going back to the National Institute of Health, reduction to 15% in FNA costs, the Association of Public Land Grants and Universities, among other organizations at the national level, went to litigation with the federal government opposing the reduction to 15%. And so that was a very, very successful at the national level. And so my role in working with these national organizations also gives us a perspective of what's happening at different institutions. So, for example, yesterday I had a meeting with urban serving institutions presidents of the APLU, Association of Public Land Grants and Universities. There were a little bit over 20 of us presidents at that meeting, talking about the issues, the challenges, how we are working on this, and trying to help each other navigate these issues and these challenges. So what's happening at University X? How does that compare to the University at Albany? What's the response at UAlbany? How does that compare to University Y, right? So there is this consortium of different organizations working together as well. And so we are not by ourselves, either as UAlbany or as a SUNY system. There is a conglomeration of organizations, agencies, and institutions of higher education working on all these issues together.
Now, I wanted to back up just a little bit because you have mentioned international students. And I wanted to know, President Rodriguez, if there has been any concerns that have been raised by international students on campus about what they may be seeing of arrests of other international students at other colleges and universities. And how is the university approaching communicating with federal law enforcement or other outside agencies?
So, of course, students at UAlbany, particularly international students at UAlbany and across the country are concerned, right? Particularly if you are on a student visa studying in the United States, they see some arrests that are occurring across the country. They see terminations of visas. And so, yes, we've heard those concerns. We have the Center for International Engagement and Global Studies here at the University at Albany. The center, along with academic affairs, is working very closely with international students, trying to address their issues, trying to address their concerns as best as we can, right? So we're working very closely with our international students at UAlbany. As I said before, academic affairs is in regular communication with international students.
Now, I also want to bring up something with how you worked with the previous White House under President Biden. You were part of the White House Commission on Educational Equity, Excellence, and Opportunity for Hispanics. When you look back on the work that you were able to do during that time and on that commission, how does that compare with the current administration? Have you received any outreach from the White House, the current administration, to offer your ideas when it comes to higher education policy and funding in this country?
Well, the commission that I worked on educational equity and workforce development was a really great commission that was established by an executive order under President Biden. The commission worked very hard to enhance and increase the quality of education and educational access, not only for Latino and Latina students, but for all students in general, although the focus was obviously Latino and Latina students. And we did a lot of what I think critically important work as well in Puerto Rico, right? And so we made a series of recommendations. I served as chair of the Higher Education Committee for that commission. And we made a number of recommendations in terms of how to improve access, how to increase funding for students and Latino students specifically, but students of low-income students in general, first-generation students as well. So I think the work that was done there was important and significant. That work is no longer taking place. That commission no longer exists at the federal level. And so we're just waiting and see to determine what happens next.
And lastly, I just wanted to ask about your advocacy for higher education. Are we at a point right now in this country where universities, colleges and universities need to actually advocate for themselves? Is this an existential argument in some ways?
You know, I think the critically important thing is to ensure that people understand the goals, the values, and the impact of higher education. I think that institutions of higher education are essential for a democratic system. We are the ones that are educating the next generations of engaged global citizens. So whether you look at any particular industry, whether it be the semiconductor industry, whether it be health or public health, whether it be climate, whether we are educating those individuals that will go on to make important contributions to their organizations, the industries, their communities at the local, at the national, and at the global level. So we play a critical role, and I think we need to continue to promote that we, the University at Albany, for example, as an institution of higher education, is here to serve the public good, and we have a significant impact. For example, you may know that last year we released an economic impact study of the university at Albany. And we have, as an institution, an economic impact of about $1.1 billion here in the city of Albany and in the capital region. We employ over 8,000 individuals within the university and outside of the university. So we are an engine for economic mobility for the entire region and the state and beyond. And so we play a critical role in engaging and educating, I should say, engaged global citizens. That is the message we need to continue to convey to our elected officials at the local, at the city, at the national, and globally, because higher education is critical for what we do, whether it be life-saving measures like our RNA Institute, who did amazing work during COVID here at the university and for our communities, whether it's focusing on myotonic dystrophy, whether it's focusing on the impact of disasters in Puerto Rico, in the Caribbean, in New York, right? There's a lot of work that we do and we contribute to the public good. That's the message that we need to continue to send to our communities locally and nationally.
Dr. Javidan Rodriguez is president of the University at Albany. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Stress. Not only do we feel stress in our necks, shoulders, and backs, but our individual cells feel it too. For decades, scientists believed the cell's response to stress was rigid and a linear chain reaction. But new research suggests the cellular response is more nuanced and adaptable than previously thought. The Best of Our Knowledge's Madeline Reynolds spoke with Maria Hachoglu, a professor of genetics at Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine, to learn more.
So scientists in general and try to form unifying mechanisms to explain things, right? Like Einstein tried to do this at the end of his career. He tried to have a unifying mechanism to explain nature, right? And this mechanism didn't exist for Einstein. So here, for the stress response, scientists believed that everything starts with a sensing mechanism that affects a single protein in the machinery of the cell, that this protein conveys signal downstream for the cell to respond. So what does the cell need to do under these conditions to preserve energy? All stress responses, you preserve energy and use the resources you have to make things, to make things better, to withstand the stress, to live under stress until you recover, right? And the major machinery in the cell that consumes energy is to make proteins. So scientists believe that there is a molecule, a protein, in the protein synthesis machinery of the cell that is being targeted, and is targeted by any stressor, internal or external, convey signals downstream. That's what it was believed. That was a kind of the unifying theory of stress sensing to convey downstream signals and have a cellular response, with the first thought being to conserve energy.
So in the research you have conducted, you have discovered that our bodies are cells. Response to stress is actually much less rigid than previously thought. So can you tell us the new response to stress and what that whole process is?
So this molecule now, we found that depending on stress intensity or cell context, can respond differently mechanistically. So the cell makes different decisions of what mechanism to activate when this molecule is affected. So it's not anymore one response by changing the activity of this molecule, of this protein in protein synthesis, but it decides differently depending on intensity, on cell contacts, and other conditions in the cell. To give you an example about this, if we take a mutation in this central unifying theory molecule in the body, right, a genetic mutation, the people develop a disease not immediately, but with a late onset. And this is the vanishing white matter disease, ataxias, neurodegeneration. So the question is, what do we do the time we don't have the disease, and what happens during the time that we have the disease? So this is the flexibility in the stress response to adapt for a while before things become bad in certain cell types that you develop the disease. So that's what we discovered. We discovered that this molecule that was the unifying mechanism of the cell response induces different mechanisms for adaptation under certain conditions and not in others. And in the case of neurodegeneration that I described, the vanishing white matter disease, all some cells in the body adapt, and we don't have disease for this genetic mutation until some external stress comes in, kills that mechanism, and disease develops. The flexibility, that's what it does.
This is called, I believe, integrated stress response, right?
Yes, integrated stress response that was thought to have one beginning before it diverts out in different programs. And now we say it's not true that the integrated stress response via that molecule, which is called the activity of the protein synthesis factory AF2B. So this integrated stress response comes with different phases depending in the cell context.
How did you conduct the study and test this ISR integrated stress response?
So we introduced a mutation in this unifying factor that was believed to be the center molecule in the integrated stress response. And we tested what happens to this factor when it has the mutation and what happens to this factor when you put an external stress. And that's where we found that there are different programs that we call split ISR, the first, when you have only the mutation that changes the activity of the factor, and classical ISR, the well-known integrated stress response by external stressors that follows a completely different mechanism. And the interesting thing is that both of these programs, right, of the flexibility of the integrated stress response programs, have one key component, which is a transcription factor that makes a lot of proteins that they are important for the stress response. So this factor now is made by two different mechanisms. One mechanism during the adaptation phase that you don't have disease, and a different mechanism during the non-adaptive phase that you have development of disease. The discovery is this flexibility of responding by different mechanisms.
In your research, there are two different types of integrated stress responses. What are they, and can you describe them both?
Yes, so we discovered what we call split ISR. And split ISR is when the activity of the factor that was considered the unifying theory of response of the integrating stress response decreases. This activity can decrease by different means, by a mutation, as I said, by signaling inside the cell, metabolic signaling, other signaling inside the cell, and makes the cell then to respond a kind of adaptively until the stress goes away. It's a transient response, or it's a response to live happily with an adaptive metabolism that this stress response brings up. So you adapt to live in this condition. When the other stress condition is which comes externally, the CISR, the classical ISR we call, is by external factors that you cannot live. You would rather either develop disease, die, or develop resistance. And in this resistance, like the chemotherapy, drug-resistant drugs, this, when it develops, it starts having survival elements of the split ISR. So that's how we view it. We view split ISR as an adaptive mechanism to survive stresses when the CISR, it's a mechanism that transiently is adaptive, but it will lead the cell to malfunction and death unless drug resistance develops, and this resistance will have SISR elements.
We now know that ISR is in fact not rigid, but rather adaptive and can adjust depending on the duration of stress and the state of the cell. So how is this crucial to the survival of our cells and the entire organism? Can you list and describe them for us?
I think it is crucial to understand what are the different adaptation mechanisms in each one of them. And in some cases, we would like to enhance them, to identify the exact mechanism and say this molecule in the mechanism needs to be targeted by drugs, either to enhance or to inhibit. For example, in neurodegenerative diseases, we would like to enhance that mechanism. And if we find key molecules, let's say that they have metabolic activity, enzymes, we can find activators, right? But in other cases, like the drug-resistant cancer cells, we would like to inhibit them. So the key of these findings we have will be now to identify the machinery and how different is one from the other, and the conditions that the two, split ISR and chronic ISR, operate in order to further develop therapies for disease, like liver disease. Liver disease will be very similar. Split ISR and CISR will have a role there, and understanding is we can stop progression of liver disease and fibrosis.
Maria Hetjoglu is a professor of genetics at Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine. Her research is published in the journal Nature. She spoke with the best of our knowledge's Madeline Reynolds. This has been the Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1802. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Madeline Reynolds. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.